Thank you. Thank you. Good evening. How are you all? We'll see. David Anderson lived in Boston with his wife Sarah and their three children, Rachel, Shannon, and Jonah. He was a very successful businessman, and one of the rewards of his success was their summer home on Martha's Vineyard. Sarah and their children spent the whole summer there, while David spent part of each weekend and always the first 2 weeks of July out at the beach with his family. One summer a few years ago, he was driving out to the beach at the beginning of July when David made a promise to himself. For 2 weeks, he was going to be a loving and attentive husband and father. He would make himself totally available. You see, David worked too much. He knew it. Everyone around him knew it. When you love your work, that's one of the dangers. From time to time, David felt guilty about how much he worked, but he usually managed to brush it aside by telling himself it was necessary. Did the rationalization succeed? Well, only temporarily. But this vacation was going to be different. David was going to be attentive and available. The idea had come to him and his car as he drove out to the beach that day. He was listening to a CD that a friend had given him. The speaker was discussing dynamic relationships, and feeling a little bit uncomfortable, David was about to switch it off when something the speaker said caught his attention. He said, "Love is a choice, not a feeling. Love is an act of the will. You can choose to love." At that moment, David admitted to himself that as a husband and a father, he had been a little bit selfish, mostly in little ways. He always insisted they watch what he wanted to watch on television. He often made Sarah feel small for being late. He seemed to be always saying "some other time" or "not now" to his wife and children. But for 2 weeks, all of that was going to change. And so it did. From the moment David walked through the door, kissed his wife and said, "You look really good in that new sweater. That's a great color for you." Sarah was taken aback, surprised. After battling the traffic, David just wanted to sit down and relax, but his wife suggested a walk on the beach. He began to refuse, but then thought better of it, thinking, "Sarah's been out here all week alone with the children, and now she wants to spend a little time with me." So they walked the beach while the kids flew their kites. The next morning, Sarah almost fell out of bed when David woke her with breakfast in bed. Admittedly, he had woken Rachel to help pull that one off, but it was extraordinary nonetheless. And over breakfast, David told Sarah about a dream he had had the night before. And Sarah thought to herself, "Who is this man? And what has he done with my husband?" Over and over throughout the days, David kept reminding himself, love is a choice, not a feeling. And so it went. For 2 weeks, they relaxed. They were happy. They had a dream vacation. 2 weeks without the constant harassment of cell phone calls and email. They visited a maritime museum, even though David hates museums. He even managed to hold his tongue when Sarah's getting ready made them late for his best friend's birthday dinner. On the second last day, Shannon said to her mother, "Mummy, did Daddy win something?" Sarah laughed, but she had been wondering herself what had come over her husband. After lunch on the last day, David excused himself and took another walk on the beach, alone this time. He thought about the promise he had made 2 weeks earlier on the way out to the beach, and now he made a new promise, to keep choosing love when they got home. That night, as he and Sarah were preparing for bed, Sarah suddenly stopped and looked at David with the saddest expression he'd ever seen come across her face. David panicked and said, "What's the matter?" And Sarah began to cry. And through the tears, she said, "Do you know something I don't know?" "What do you mean?" David asked. Sarah continued, "That checkup I had a few weeks ago, did Dr. Lewis tell you something about me? Dave, you've been so good to me. Am I dying?" David's eyes began to fill with tears, and wrapping her in his arms and holding her tight, he said, "No, honey, you're not dying. I'm just starting to live. Life's about love. We know it instinctively, but we get distracted. We know that life is instinctively. We know it's about love, but we get distracted. What do we get distracted by? All the urgent things. Every day you wake up, there's a whole list of urgent things for you to do. Yes or yes? Every day you wake up, whole list of urgent things. Maybe your list of urgent things is on your computer. Maybe your list of urgent things is in your planner. Maybe your list of urgent things is in your mind. Maybe your list of urgent things is on your fridge. Maybe your list of urgent things to do is in your spouse's mind. But every day you wake up, every day you wake up, there's a whole list of urgent things for you to do. What do? We rush around doing all our urgent things. We rush around doing all our urgent things. We spend our lives rushing around doing our urgent things. What's the problem with that? The most important things are hardly ever urgent. The most important things, they're hardly ever urgent. We live in a world of infinite opportunity now. We live in a world where infinite number of activities are competing for our time. There was a time where we could say to ourselves, I'll do the urgent stuff now, and I'll get to that other stuff later. We don't get there anymore. We've got to get back to the fact that life is about love. We get distracted. Love, intimacy, what is it? What is it? Well, intimacy is not sex. Sex doesn't equal intimacy. Sex doesn't guarantee intimacy. Sex isn't even necessary for intimacy. Intimacy isn't something that just belongs between husband and wife. Intimacy is something that belongs in all of our significant relationships. Between brothers and sisters, and parents and children, and friends and colleagues, and yes, husbands and wives and boyfriends and girlfriends. What is intimacy? Intimacy is me revealing myself to you, and you revealing yourself to me. Intimacy is to know and be known. But very often we don't reveal ourselves. Rather than reveal ourselves, we hide ourselves. We hide ourselves. We spend a lot of time, effort, energy in relationships hiding ourselves rather than revealing ourselves. Why? We're afraid. Afraid of what? We're afraid that if people really knew us, they wouldn't love us anymore. That's our core fear in relationship. We're afraid that if people really knew us, they wouldn't love us anymore. And so we don't reveal ourselves, we hide ourselves. And then when they do come and say, oh, I love you, in the back of our minds we're thinking, no, you love the person you think I am. When they do come to us and say, oh, I really love you, we're thinking to ourselves, yeah, but if you really knew me, you wouldn't love me anymore. So even when people do love us, we're not able to receive their love because we haven't revealed ourselves. What's the opposite of intimacy? Loneliness. Loneliness, the opposite of intimacy. Can you imagine the loneliness, the quiet desperation of passing through this life and never really being known? That's loneliness. And you can be in a crowd and be lonely. You can be in a relationship and be desperately lonely. You can be in a relationship that other people think is a great relationship and still be desperately lonely because you're not known, because you either don't have the ability or don't have the opportunity to reveal yourself. We all want great relationships. I think that, you know, in my travels around the world in the last 10 years, the one thing I'm absolutely convinced of is that people don't fail because they want to fail. People don't fail because they want to fail. People don't get married to get divorced. People fail because they don't know how to succeed. We've got to find a path. We've got to find a way to have the great relationships that we all yearn for. Culture tells us, you want to have a great relationship? Build it on common interests. Common interests are not enough. You need more than that because our interests change. Yes or yes? Yeah, our interests change, and as our interests change, if our relationships are built on our relationships change and very often fall apart. There's an epidemic at this moment in history across America, people getting divorced in their late 50s, early 60s. I look at this and I've studied this and it baffled me for the longest time, and then all of a sudden, it struck me. They had a common interest, raising their children. They raised their children 20 years, 25 years, didn't do anything but raise their children. Children are raised, they look at each other and think, we don't have a relationship anymore. We don't know each other anymore. How do common interests, change? Relationship change. Common interests are not enough. We need a common, unchanging purpose because we live in a world of infinite change. We live in a world of rapid and constant change. And in a world of rapid change, the question you've got to ask yourself is, what do you have in your life that's unchanging? Because it's what's unchanging in your life that makes sense of change. It's what's unchanging in your life that allows you to thrive in the midst of change. What's unchanging? We need this common, unchanging purpose. As individuals, it's God's dream for us to become the best version of ourselves. That's God's dream for you. He wants you to become the best version of yourself. And every time we make a choice, the only question we've got to ask ourselves is that going to help me become the best version of myself? Every opportunity, every crisis can be measured in relation to this unchanging purpose. In relationships, we need that too. You go to work each day, you know the purpose of that. You go to play football, you know the purpose of that. We got to know the purpose. What is the purpose? The unchanging purpose of a relationship? You helping me become the best version of myself, me helping you become the best version of yourself. That's the purpose of relationships. Two people helping each other become the best version of themselves. That's the purpose. And when we get to the third level of intimacy, you'll understand how important that is. But once we've got that clearly established, then we're ready. The seven levels of intimacy. The first level of intimacy, cliches. In the first level of intimacy, we're just talking cliches. Who are the experts at this? Teenagers. Teenagers, they're so good at this. How's your day? Fine. What did you do? Fine. What do you want for dinner? Fine. Where are you going? Don't know. Who's going to be there? Don't know. Who's driving? Don't know. Can I have some money? The first level of intimacy, cliches. And we all use cliches from time to time to avoid intimacy. And that's what teenagers do. They don't talk to their friends like that. They only talk to certain adults like that. And when we get to the third level of intimacy, we're going to talk about why teenagers do that. But in the first level of intimacy, we use cliches. And cliches, of course, can lead to intimacy, or cliches can be used to avoid intimacy. The second level of intimacy, facts. We talk about the facts. We talk about the weather. We talk about the weather. We talk about the ball game, the stock market, the food, and we talk some more about the weather. Because we can use the facts to avoid intimacy. Facts can lead to intimacy, or we can use the facts to avoid intimacy, and very often we do. We use the facts to avoid intimacy rather than leading into intimacy. The third level of intimacy, this is where we all get into trouble. The third level of intimacy, this is the Pandora's box in the process. Opinions. Yeah? And that's where it starts. It starts with the opinions, because we've all got different opinions. Yes or yes? Yeah, why? Because where do opinions come from? You're not born with them. Opinions born from two things, education and experience. Education and experience give birth to opinions. We all have different education, we all have different experiences, so it stands to reason that we would have different opinions. But you know, we meet someone with a different opinion, we're like shocked. What do? Oh, we got to talk about this. Sit down, we need to talk about this. Come on, sit down, we're going to get through this. We've got to get through this, which basically means when we get through this, your opinion will be my opinion. It doesn't sound right, does it? We'll call it our opinion then, so it doesn't matter. So what happens? People meet each other. Someone has a different opinion. They feel like they have to fight it out to the death. You know, what do you got? You got people married 10, 20, 30, 40 years, been arguing about the same thing for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. They don't even remember what they're arguing about anymore. They're just arguing. Because most of us don't have the maturity to sit at a table with someone who has a different opinion and accept, you know what, they've had different education, they've had different experiences, it stands to reason that their opinion would be. Raise your hand if you have every single opinion is exactly the same as it was 10 years ago. None of us. Our opinions are constantly changing, they're growing, they're evolving. As our experience of life changes and grows, evolves, as we have more education and more experiences, our opinions change, but we forget that when we meet someone with a different opinion. Average American lives for 77 years. We meet him on one day, at one moment, they express one opinion. We judge them, box them, categorize them, dismiss them. They're done. You know, and then we hear someone talking about him 20 years later. Oh, yeah, I met that guy 20 years ago. Yeah, he's a liberal. That's what we do. Judge them, box them, categorize them, set them aside. Because most of us don't have the maturity to accept that people have different opinions and that their opinions are still evolving based on new experiences and new education. So we feel like we have to fight it out to the death. Why? We're no good at healthy conflict. We're no good at healthy conflict in relationships and in the church. Particularly horrible at it in the church, you know? What happens? You like have a committee meeting. You know, you join some volunteer thing, you show up for some meeting, have a committee meeting, meeting's going along quite nicely. And then what happens? Somebody comes up with the worst idea in the history of the organization. What does everyone else do? Nod and smile. And then what do they do? Start to make noises. And then nobody knows what to say. Nobody knows what to say. So somebody would say, you know what? That is a great idea. Yeah. We can't have any conflict. Let's just lie to each other instead. That's better. Yeah. That is a great idea. Why did we think of that before you showed up? What a great idea. Everyone else will nod their head and smile and make noises. And then what happens? And then somebody will say, but you know what? That is such a good idea. We don't have time in this meeting to really do justice to that idea. We better either have another meeting just for that idea, or let's put it on the agenda for the next meeting where we really can do that meeting, that idea, justice. Everyone nods and smiles and makes their noises. Then what do? We go out in the car park and talk about the idiot with a stupid idea. Yeah. No, we're Christian, we can't have any conflict. Let's just lie to each other. We're Christian, let's not have any conflict. Let's have that good Christian gossip in the car park. That's better. Yeah, that's better. That's much better. Yeah. Why aren't we good at conflict? We're not good at conflict because we don't know the purpose. Common, unchanging purpose. Because when we've got a common unchanging purpose, when you and I know that the common unchanging purpose of our relationship is to help each other become the best version of ourselves, when we have a disagreement, we can have it in relation to that. Then it's not your idea against my idea. It's not your opinion against my opinion. It's not a battle of the egos. We can talk about it in relation to something outside of ourselves, which is this common purpose to help each other become the best version of ourselves. It's the only way to have healthy conflict in relationships, in any organization, in any committee. You sit down to a committee meeting, you've got to know what is the purpose of this committee. Because when we have a purpose, I don't have to put your idea down. I don't have to make it a personal attack. We can just talk about, okay, how does that idea help us fulfill this purpose? And when it doesn't, then we can move on. It's not a battle of the egos, it's not a personal attack. The reason we struggle in this third level is because we live in a hyper-judgmental culture. We live in a culture where we're told constantly that love is based on understanding. What does our culture tell us love is based on? Understanding. But it's a lie. It's a lie, it's a myth. But because of that lie, we're set up to fail from the start. Because if love is based on understanding, then I'll love you when I understand you. And good luck with that. I even understand myself some days, you know, most days in fact, never mind understand another person. That's like standing at the fire this winter and saying, I'll give you wood when you give me heat. Come on now. Be a cold winter, wouldn't it? But that's what happens. Our culture tells us love is based on understanding, which sets us up to fail from the start, because then we hold back our love. We say, I'll give you my love when I understand you. Truth is, love is not based on understanding. Love is based on acceptance. Love is based on acceptance. You think about who you're most likely to reveal yourself to. Someone who's constantly judging you, someone who's constantly criticizing you, someone who's constantly telling you did it wrong or constantly telling you a better way. You're not likely to reveal yourself to those, so you'll hide yourself from those people forever. You're most likely to reveal yourself to someone you feel accepted by. Someone you feel accepted by. That's who you're going to reveal yourself to. Someone who accepts you. And that's why teenagers don't talk to adults. They feel like every time they open their mouth, they'll be judged, criticized, told they did it wrong, told a better way. They're done. Whatever. Fine. Dunno. Can I have some money? They'll give you the cliche first level treatment forever. Until they feel accepted. Till they feel accepted. The key to intimacy is acceptance. Foundation of love is acceptance. Because when we feel accepted, we thrive. Yes or yes? When we feel accepted, that's when we begin to blossom. That's when we begin to bloom, when we feel accepted. And that's the key. But most of us don't have the maturity to accept that someone is in a journey. It's taking them somewhere. For most of us, it's a 77-year-plus journey. It's taking us somewhere. We're just meeting them partway along the path. We've got to accept that. We've got to honor that. We've got to ask ourselves, how can we best help them in that journey toward the best version of themselves, rather than feeling like we have to fight it out to the death? But you'll go to a dinner party sometime here over the Christmas season. People will be sitting around. Conversation will be going along lovely. And then all of a sudden, someone will express an opinion. Faces will begin to go red. Veins will begin to bulge out of necks. And people will recognize this. There'll be an awkward moment. There'll be an uncomfortable moment. And then what will happen? Tell you what will happen. Somebody will use a resurfacing technique. Yeah, just like a submarine. Resurfacing technique. Someone will say, ooh, level 3, let's get out of here. What's a resurfacing technique? Someone a sarcasm? Yeah, sarcasm, the classic resurf. You can avoid a whole lifetime of intimacy with sarcasm. Yeah, or someone will just make a joke, or someone will just change the topic. I mean, just change the topic out of nowhere. Or the all-time favorite resurfacing technique. Somebody will stand up and say, shall we have some coffee now? Level 1, level 2, level 3, opinion, let's get out of here. That's the great danger in our relationships, is that we run away from intimacy. We're afraid of it. We yearn for it desperately, and yet we're desperately afraid of it. You know, it's the one thing we cannot live happily without. You can survive without it, but you can't thrive without it. Intimacy, 7 levels. Number 1, cliche. Number 2, facts. Number 3, opinions. Number 4, I think the 4th level of intimacy is my favorite. If you've got a relationship that's struggling, if you've got a relationship that you'd like to see thrive in a new way, I think the 4th level of intimacy is your best friend. The 4th level of intimacy? Hopes and dreams. Hopes and dreams. You see, we're driven by our dreams. Nothing animates the human person like the pursuit of a dream. Passionately, energetically, enthusiastically, like chasing down a dream. There's nothing more fulfilling than chasing down a dream. There's nothing more satisfying than helping someone else live a dream. Do you know what your dreams are? You know, or did you stop dreaming somewhere along the way? Because we do. We get caught up in the hustle and bustle of life, and we just stop dreaming. What's your dream? What are your dreams? And do you know the dreams of the people around you? Do you know the dreams of the people around you? You know, once a year at the foundation, I like to sit down with my staff and talk about their dreams. We did it about a month ago. And every year I'm amazed at the dreams people have. People we work with every day, you know, that have these dreams that you just never really get to in the course of your daily interaction. It's amazing the dreams people have in their lives, in their hearts. But you know what I find myself thinking about for the last month? I'm talking to these people, they're sending me emails, we're on the phone, we're in meetings. Do you know what I find myself thinking about? Their dreams. I find myself thinking, how can I help them live that dream? How can I help him get at that one? How can I help her achieve that dream? And you know what? I don't think my response is extraordinary. I really don't. I think my response is human. I think when we know the dreams of the people around us, we want to help them live those dreams. I really do. I think when we know the dreams of the people around us, we want to help them live those dreams. Yeah, do you know what your dreams are? Do you know the dreams of the people around you? Because nothing can breathe energy, passion, vitality into your relationship like the pursuit of some dreams. You know, I've got a dream book. I call it a dream book. It's a journal. I write all my dreams in it. Books I want to write, qualities I want to have in my character. Sometimes I'll flip through a magazine. I'll see something I like, I'll cut it out, I'll stick it in my dream book. You know, sometimes I'll see a really great quote, cut it out, stick it in my dream book. And then each day I flip through my dream book. Usually when I'm on the treadmill, just flip through my dream book. You know, and for that hour, I just flip through my dream book, think about, pray about my dreams. And it's amazing how those dreams begin to emerge. It's amazing how they begin to emerge in our lives once we start to put them in our minds. I've had my dream book for 11 years, and I wrote one dream in there 10 and a half years ago. And it was to walk the Camino, or the Old Road to Santiago, which is a 500-mile walk from the south of France, direct south across the Pyrenees, and then direct west across northern Spain. I wrote it in my dream book 10 and a half years ago, and when I first heard about it, it really enchanted me, and I thought that would be really great. You know, I probably never thought I'd really do it, but I wrote it in my dream book nonetheless. I probably never thought I'd do it. I mean, how are you going to take a month off, you know, to take a walk? You know? What are you doing? I'm taking a month off. What for? I'm take a walk. This past June, flew over to southern France, backpack, map, started walking. 10, 12, 14 hours a day walking. 25 miles a day walking. No cell phone, no phones, no internet, no television, no iPod, no music, just walking. Me and my dream book. Powerful experience, life-changing. What's your dream? What are your dreams? And what are you doing about them? Do you know the dreams of the people around you? Maybe the first question is to sit your husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, or hopefully just one of those. Hopefully. Maybe the first question is to sit down and say, which of your dreams got lost along the way while I was too busy pursuing my own dreams? Which of your dreams got sacrificed because I was too preoccupied with my own dreams? Do you know the dreams of the people around you? Get yourself a dream book. Husband and wife, get one dream book and share it. You know why? Because you're not likely to talk about your dreams every day or every week or even every month. And then what happens? You know, resentment. I told him about that dream 10 years ago. Has he done anything to help me? Nothing. Nothing. Get yourself a dream book. Write your dreams in there. Husband, wife, write your dreams in there. Date your dreams once a month, 15 minutes together. Talk about your dreams. How are we doing in this one? Good. How are we doing in this one? We're going to do that one next summer. How are we doing in this one? You know what? That one's really not that important anymore. When we wrote it down, we thought it was important, but now we realize that's not really going to help us become the best version of ourselves. The fourth level of intimacy, hopes and dreams. The fifth level of intimacy, feelings. Yes, guys, feelings. Normally two or three guys get up at about now and walk out. You know, honey, I gotta go to the bathroom. Feelings. Traditionally, us guys get a really bad rap for the feelings thing, don't we, guys? Yes or yes? Yeah. Truth is, you women, you aren't that good at it either. You think I'm joking. You see, the fifth level of intimacy, it's about feelings. It's about knowing our feelings and being comfortable expressing our feelings and expressing our feelings at the right time, in the right place, to the right person. Now, us guys, hey, we can admit it. We're not always that good at knowing our feelings and being comfortable expressing our feelings. But you women, yeah, not so good at the right time, right place, right person side of the equation. And that's what creates the friction. And this problem is created because our culture tells us that love is based on what? Guys, I'm really getting the feeling like you're not picking this stuff up. I think we better start again. David Anderson lived in Boston with his wife, Sarah, and their three children, Rachel, Shannon, and Jonah. Our culture tells us love is based on what?
Understanding.
Understanding, but it's a lie. But because we accept the lie, then it creates the equation. If love is based on understanding, then every feeling needs a reason. Now we're in trouble. I can't love you unless I understand you. And now you've got this feeling. You're going to definitely be needing a reason for that feeling. Truth is that love is not based on understanding. Love is based on acceptance. Some feelings, you can get at the reasons. I mean, there's reasons there for them, but you can't always get to them. Some feelings you can. How are you? Great. How was your day? Great. What happened? Got a promotion. Reasons, feelings. Or, how was your day? Horrible. What happened? Crashed my new car and lost my job. Why is that funny? I mean, that's why we have problems in relationships. Right there. Some feelings we can get at the reasons, but we can't always. Love is not based on understanding. Love is based on acceptance. The key to the fifth level, acceptance. Feelings to be accepted. You're in a great mood, let's accept that. Let's celebrate that. You're in a horrible mood, let's be there for you in that. And sometimes being there for you means being with you. And sometimes being there for you means giving you your space. The fifth level of intimacy, feelings. The sixth level of intimacy, fears, faults, and failures. We've all got fears. We've got that core fear that if people really knew us, they wouldn't love us anymore. But other than that, we've got other fears. We've got a plethora of fears. And just as dreams drive us toward the best version of ourselves, our fears drive us away from the best version of ourselves. Do you know what your fears are? Do you know the fears of the people around you? Husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, friends, colleagues, children, parents. Do you know your fears? Do you know the fears of the people that surround you? Because we're driven in a different way, in a crazy way, by our fears. You see, what people do is interesting. What people say, very interesting. But why people do what they do and say what they say? Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. So when someone comes up with an opinion, rather than jumping down their throat trying to tell them that they're wrong, the question we've really got to ask ourselves is, where did that opinion come from? What happened in your life to give you that opinion? Because it came from somewhere. Someone expresses in a feeling, a dream, a fear. Where did it come from? We weren't born with them. What happened in your life to give you that opinion, that feeling, that fear, that dream? Where did it come from? What people do and say? Interesting. Why people do what they do and say what they say? Absolutely fascinating. Intimacy is getting to that why. Rather than the prejudgment, the quick judgment, the hyper-judgmental, it's getting to the why do people do what they do and say what they say. That's intimacy. Do you know what your fears are? You know, we've all got them. And nothing kills intimacy like fears. Think about it. In the garden, Adam, Eve. Take the fruit, eat the fruit. Who shows up then? God. What do? Hide. They hide. Adam, God comes into the garden. He says, where are you? What does Adam say? We were naked and afraid, so we hid ourselves. First time in human history, man was ever afraid. What's his first reaction to fear? Hide. Hid himself. When we're afraid, we won't reveal ourselves. Intimacy. When we're afraid, we'll hide ourselves. Loneliness. Isolation. Do you know what your fears are? Faults. I'm telling you, you get to this place, you got something powerful. The sixth level of intimacy, the second part of the sixth level of intimacy where we deal with faults, one person can come to another person and say, you know what? I got this fault, and I know it's stopping me from becoming the best version of myself. And I was hoping you could help me overcome that. What do you got? You got humility. You got vulnerability. The two key ingredients missing in modern relationships. for one person to be able to come to another person and say, you know what, I've got a problem, I've got this fault, I know it's stopping me from becoming the best version of myself, can you help me with this? And then for the other person to turn around and say, yep, I want to help you with that, but I don't want to nag you. So how is the best way for me to help you with that? How's the best way for me to help you with that? If I see it happening, do you want me to say something? What do you want me to say? How do you want me to say it so that you can react, so that you can respond? You know, or maybe you don't want me to say anything at all. Maybe if I see it happening, you want me just to touch you on the arm. And that'll be enough for you to realize it's happening and short-circuit it. Or maybe you just want me, if I see it happening, you just want me to jot you a note at the end of the day and say, you know what, I saw this happen. I know you're trying to work on that. That, you get there, you're there. Intimacy. To be able to come to someone and say, you know what, I got this fault, can you help me with that? And then for the other person to turn around. But most of the time, we spend most of our lives arguing for our faults. You know, as if we deserve our faults. You know, as if we're justified in our faults, or as if they're somebody else's fault. Do you know what your faults are? Do you know what your faults are? And the third part of the sixth level of intimacy is failures. You know, we all do stupid things from time to time. I remember when I used to do stupid things. I remember growing up, I would do stupid things from time to time. And my mother would always send my father to straighten me out. You know, my dad would come to my room, and my dad was a very calm man. A very calm, wise man. And he would come. You know, the first thing he'd do? Tell me a story. Didn't matter if I was 6 or 16. First thing he'd do? Tell me a story. About what? About when he did something stupid in his life. Made himself vulnerable. Made himself vulnerable. Created connection, created a bond, opened the doors of intimacy. And then what did he do? Tell me, Matthew, you've done a stupid thing. We can build you a path out of here. You want to build a path to a richer, more abundant life, future? We can do that. And if you want to do that, I want to help you do that. But let's just be clear, you've done a stupid thing here. The people around you know what your failures are. Do you reveal your humanity? Because when we reveal our humanity, we give other people permission to be human. And that's important in relationships. But what do? We always try to put our best foot forward, don't we? You know, you go to a job interview, you put your best foot forward. Ever tried walking with your best foot forward all the time? It's a problem. The sixth level of intimacy, fears, faults, failures. The seventh level of intimacy, legitimate needs. You've got them. If you don't eat, you'll die. Legitimate need. If you don't breathe, you'll die even quicker. Legitimate need. We've all got legitimate needs, physically, emotionally, intellectually, and spiritually. Who gave them to us? God. What for? Clues. Clues to what? Happiness. He wants you to be happy. He gave you these clues. He created you with these clues in you. Physically, emotionally, intellectually, spiritually. Legitimate needs. Clues to happiness. Clues to thriving. And they're pretty simple things. I mean, when you look at it, what are they? Physically, exercise regularly, eat the right sorts of food, sleep regularly. You'll be happier, you'll thrive, you'll feel better about yourself, you'll feel better about life. Emotionally, give focus and priority to your relationships. You'll feel better about life, you'll be more fully alive, healthier, you're happier. Intellectually, books. Read great books. Books change our lives. I like to come to your house sometime. I like to see your books. You show me your books, and I will tell you what sort of a person you are. You tell me the 10 books you're going to read in the next 12 months, and I'll tell you how your life will change in the next 12 months. If you've got a bookcase, I want to see what's at eyeline. Tells me what you think's important, you know? And I want to see what's in down in some little corner, you know? When I come by, there better not be any Matthew Kelly books down there. Books. You know, I want to see what books you've got, which ones are underlined, which ones are highlighted, what you've written in the columns, which ones are dog-eared, which ones aren't read first past the first few pages. You show me your books, I will tell you what sort of a person you are. You tell me the 10 books you're going to read in the next 12 months, and I will tell you how your life will change next year. we become the books we read. Read great books. They expand our vision of ourselves. They expand our vision of the world. They make us more focused, more alert, more vibrant, more vital. And when we read great books, we feel more fully alive. We're happier when we read great books. We're happier. Intellectually, you have a legitimate need to expand your vision of yourself and expand your vision of the world. Spiritually, what are our legitimate needs? Spiritually, silence, solitude, scriptures, sacraments. Silence, solitude, scriptures, sacraments. When we immerse ourselves in these things, we're just happier. We feel better about ourselves and we feel better about life. We feel more fully alive. Physically, emotionally, intellectually, spiritually, our legitimate needs are pretty simple things and they're pretty cheap for the most part. But we ignore them. We ignore them. We set them aside. We don't give them the attention they should. Why? Because we live in a culture that's all consumed with wants. Wants. We live in a culture all consumed with wants. We live in a culture that says, you go out and get what you want, and then you'll be happy. This is the philosophy that has been driving our culture for 50 years. Yeah, for 50 years, people have been saying, you go out and get what you want, and then you'll be happy. You know, but the philosophy of go out and get what you want has failed. It's a failed experiment, but we can't tell anybody. We've got to keep it a secret. Why? Because our whole culture's built on it. The whole thing had become tumbling down if anybody found out. The philosophy of go out and get what you want and then you'll be happy doesn't work. It's failed. For 50 years, people have been going out and getting what they want on an ever-increasing basis. Have a look out there. There's no evidence to suggest that that makes people happy. The opposite is in evidence. People are more irritable, more restless, more discontented than ever before. Why? Because the philosophy of go out and get what you want doesn't work. It's failed. You simply never can get enough of what you don't really need. Never. You never can get enough of what you don't really need. You can only ever get enough of what you need. That's why there's so little contentment out there. They tell us we live in a consumer society. I got a couple of serious questions about that. Question number one, are we still the consumers or have we been consumed by this multinational economic deal? Are we still the consumers or have we just become cogs in the global economic wheel? I mean, the world's gone brand crazy, hasn't it? It's like brand mania out there. It's like everything's got a brand on it. You know, absolutely everything's got a brand on it now. Anyone tell me, when was the first time, what was the first use for branding? Cattle. You got it. Cattle. And branding signified what? Ownership. Do we own the brands or do the brands own us? We got to switch our focus off of what we want and onto what we need. That's where our happiness lies. That's when we begin to thrive as individuals, in relationships, and in community. The pinnacle of intimacy is where two people can sit down and say, these are my legitimate needs, physically, emotionally, intellectually, spiritually. What are your legitimate needs? Let's build a life around our legitimate needs. You get to that place, you're there. Seven levels of intimacy. Clichés, facts, opinions, hopes and dreams, feelings, fears, faults and failures, and legitimate needs. How does it work? It's not like you wake up tomorrow and say, honey, we did level two yesterday. Let's do level three today. No, it doesn't work like that. You're going to go in and out of these levels. You know, I think the power of it is that it's self-evident. You're going to go places tomorrow. You're going to say, that's level three right there. That's level one. They need some level five. I think it's self-evident. And I think that's the power of it, is that it takes something very complicated and makes it manageable. And allows us in real and practical ways to begin to look at our relationships and say, we need some work on that. We're doing really good at that. What are our hopes and dreams? Maybe we need to get at that fourth level. I think that's the power of it. I think that's the power of it. What does it take? I mean, if you really want this intimacy, what does it take? I think one ingredient above everything else, carefree timelessness. Carefree timelessness. Who are the experts? Teenagers. What do? Talk on the phone. How long do they talk for? Forever. So Johnny gets off the phone. Johnny's on the phone for 4 hours. Johnny gets off the phone. He said, Johnny, who are you talking to? Johnny says, Melanie. She said, Johnny, what did you guys talk about? What does Johnny say?
Nothing.
Carefree timelessness. That is the reason young people fall in love so easily. Carefree timelessness. That's the reason young people fall in love so easily. The rest of us fall out of love pretty easily when we start starving our relationships of that carefree timelessness. Got to gift our relationships. You gift any relationship in your life with that carefree timelessness, it'll begin to blossom, it'll begin to bloom, it'll begin to thrive. It will begin to thrive. You know, what's the danger in all of this? I think the danger is you say to yourself, oh, I'm too old for that stuff. Leave me alone. You know, gee, I'm glad my wife wasn't here tonight. She would be nagging me, level 2, level 5, level 8. I'm too old for that stuff. Leave me alone. What's the other danger? The other danger, you say to yourself, oh, I'm too young for that stuff. No, too young for that stuff. Now's my time to have fun. Can't be thinking about all these big questions, deep meaning, common, unchanging purposes. Leave me alone. Most people spend the first half of their life saying, I'm too young for that stuff. And the second half of their life saying, I'm too old for that stuff. And Thoreau was right. Most people lead lives of quiet desperation. Do not say, I'm too old. Do not say, I'm too young. Mozart was 8 years old when he wrote his first symphony. Charles Dickens, 12 years old when he quit school to work in a factory because his father had been in prison for debt and he needed money to get his father out of jail. Anne Frank was 13 years old when she began her diary. Ralph Waldo Emerson, 14 years old when he enrolled at Harvard. Joe DiMaggio was 26 years old when he hit safely for 56 consecutive games without steroids. Extraordinary. William Shakespeare was 31 years old when he wrote Romeo and Juliet. Thomas Jefferson, 33 years old when he wrote the Declaration of Independence. Mother Teresa, 40 years old when she began her work in Calcutta. 40 years old when she began her work in Calcutta. 40 years old, she started a new life. 40 years old, she sat with God in the classroom of silence and dreamt a new dream. I got friends who turned 40. I got friends who turn 40, they say, well, that's that. I just got to keep telling myself, keep it together. Keep it together, keep it together, keep it together, keep it together. 40 years old, Mother Teresa dreams a new dream, and in the next 20 years of her life, she captures the imagination, the whole world. Do not say, I am too old. Do not say, I'm too young. Pablo Picasso, 55 years old when he painted Guernica. Oscar Hammerstein, 64 years old when he wrote The Sound of Music. Winston Churchill, 65 years old when he became Britain's Prime Minister and took on Hitler. Nelson Mandela, 71 years old when he was released from more than 20 years in South African prison. 4 years later, at the age of 75, he's elected President of South Africa. Michelangelo, 72 years old when he designed the dome of St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. Benjamin Franklin, 79 years old when he invented bifocals. And aren't you glad he did? Yeah, it's not like it was the only thing he did with his life, but you're still pretty happy he didn't retire at 65. Frank Lloyd Wright was 91 years old when he finished his work on the Guggenheim Museum. Dimitri Yordandis was 98 years old when he ran a marathon. Dimitri Yordandis was 98 years old when he ran a marathon. And Arichi Uraya was 100 years old when he climbed Mount Fuji. Do not say, I'm too old. Do not say, I'm too young. Now is your time. Now is your time. What's your dream? What's your dream? And what are you doing about it? Because life's about love. You know, what's it really all about? You know, it doesn't matter what sort of shoes you wear. You know, life's not about whether or not you wear Nikes or Reeboks. You know, life's not about what street you live on or how big your house is or what sort of job you have. Or, you know, life's not about how much money you make or how much money you have. Life's not about what college you went to or what college your kids might go to or whether or not you made a football team or what position you had on the football team. Life's not about these things. Life's not about, you know, whether or not you have expensive clothes with fancy labels on them or whether or not you can vacation in all the right places every year. Life's about love. About who you love and who you hurt. About how you love and hurt yourself. Really. It's about how you love and hurt those people close to you. It's about how you love and hurt those people who just brush past your world on any given day. Life's about love. We know it instinctively, but we get distracted, don't we? It's about stepping away from those distractions, not immersing ourselves in ever more of them. So life is about love, but we do get distracted. So if you just had one more phone call to make, or you just had one more letter to write, who would you call? Who would you write? And what would you say? And why are you waiting? Why are you waiting? Because life's about love. Good night.